Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, and with me as always is my trusty sidekick,
David Leopold, the Creative Director.
Today's podcast, we are celebrating 50 years, that's the golden anniversary,
right,
of the book The Lively Years, which is a Hirschfeld book people might not know about. If you're just a casual Hirschfeld person, you might not have heard of The Lively Years.
And yet, it's a really important book. Yeah. It is a book in which he did more than 50 new drawings for.
Wow.
And of some of the most famous plays of the last century.
That's got to be a record. 50 new drawings for one book?
Yes. It's the most drawings he ever did for a book of any kind.
Wow.
You know, new drawings. Of course, there were collections of his work that have hundreds of drawings, but these were drawn for the book. And it's an incredible book. And strangely enough, it started off as the publisher, which was Association Press. And I decided to look up what Association Press published. And mostly self-help books. They had a YMCA diving and swimming series.
Series. So there were multiple of these.
Yes.
YMCA books. Wow.
And then in and amongst this is The Lively Years by Brooks Atkinson and Al Hirschfeld. But it turns out the publisher had originally come to Hirschfeld and wanted to do a collection of drawings. You know, as always, they wanted him to pick his favorites or the best or something. And Hirschfeld, who famously did not like to pick the favorite or the best of things, that's not how he saw life, decided it would be a better book if they opened it up a little bit and brought and had a specific theme, and getting a good writer like Brooks Atkinson. And at first, on the idea that it would be the best of the theater, Brooks seemed to be the most obvious choice for that. But when Brooks Atkinson got involved, he thought best of, who cares? You know, that's not the most interesting thing. He thought, if we're going to look back, let's look at the plays that really made a difference. You know, and so I don't know how much you're aware of Brooks Atkinson. As Brooks Atkinson wrote in the foreword to the book, he wrote, the plays discussed in this book are not the best of the 1920 to 1973 period, but some are definitely among the best, such as The Adding Machine, Our Town, The Visit. They say something original and important about people. This book is concerned with plays that criticize life, that wrestle with the dilemmas of civilized life. So he was looking for, he identified it was sort of an American dramatic theme to look at the life that people were living and sort of pointing out the inequities. Not in a sort of pejorative way or a put-down way, but as a way to say, this needs to be reformed because we can do better. You know, they had faith in America.
The plays were saying this.
Yes, that's how he saw it.
So he was, Brooks Atkinson was choosing plays. I'm just trying to clarify so we all.
Yeah.
Because Brooks Atkinson was looking to reflect on the plays that made a statement, maybe?
Yes.
Or had meaning, or...
He talks about the plays that that mirror the important issues of their times.
I see. Got it.
So it's... And he talks about in interviews that the difference of American plays that were criticizing life is they had this optimism, like this is something wrong and it can be fixed.
We can fix it.
Whereas he felt the Europeans and the British, particularly after World War II, they were much better at the nihilism. You know,
good reason. I mean, our country was not destroyed like they were in Europe. You know,
oh, sure.
Walking down the street in Europe at post-World War II, you can see how you might get into this nihilistic, everything is bad and there's no hope, there's no future. Whereas over here, you know, we were untouched in our countryside, you know, in our day-to-day life, we didn't have to confront that as much. I don't want this to turn into a history lesson.
No.
But that makes sense. Like,
no,
why the British might be a little bit more down,
right,
and why they don't see the future as bright as we might have been able to.
Well, and what they had experienced in America, the Great Depression, you know, should have been something that really tore the country apart, and there was leadership, FDR, who gave them optimism.
Right.
And they, so the country was sort of used to that. Mm. And that's how people looked at life. Like, okay, we've got problems, but we together we can fix them.
Yeah. That's
nice. And that maybe not necessarily is so true today, but certainly in the first half or the first three quarters of the 20th century,
yeah.
that is how I think intelligent writers looked at America.
Mm. Fascinating. Are these plays mostly written by Americans then?
No, well, there's The Visit by Frederick Dernemaugh, which is a German play. RUR is really a Russian play.
Mm.
There's certainly English plays. Waiting for Godot is it an Irish play or is it a French play because it was written in French? So there's a number of European works in there, but he's talking about the American stage,
right? Talking about really that's what I was going to say. We're talking about Broadway production, so in a sense, they're all American in that way.
The original title of the book was going to be Hirschfeld's Broadway.
Oh.
And it was only through getting Atkinson involved and him sort of coming up with a new focus of it that it became The Lively Years.
And who came up with the name? I was going to ask, where does the name Lively Years come from?
My guess is it comes from Atkinson.
Okay.
Because that's how he saw it. You know, they had all, you know, John Mason Brown had referred to plays of the 1930s as the rich, lean years. Because there were great plays coming out, but they were, of course, there wasn't any money, you know, and people were hungry. And so they were
theater when you're hungry.
Yeah.
Unless you're an actor.
Right. Exactly. So I think he was looking at this period, you know, for Atkinson. And I think to a great part, Hirschfeld, this wasn't ancient history.
Right.
You know, plays for the 1920s would be like plays for the 1970s today.
Right.
And if you were alive during that time, I saw plays on Broadway in the 1970s, and it doesn't seem that long ago to me. So I imagine for them, and these were two men who really loved the theater.
There are lots of important people or satellites in the world of Hirschfeld, if we're talking, if we're doing a globe analogy.
Sure.
Hirschfeld's the globe, and we've got all these little satellites. Brooks Atkinson is one of those, a pretty big satellite in the world of Hirschfeld.
Oh, yeah.
That I think maybe not everybody might know who he is. There was, up until very recently, a Broadway theater named the Brooks Atkinson Theater. I think it's now the Lena Horne. Is that correct?
Sure.
So he was a really important theatrical figure in the 20th century who's unfortunately mostly forgotten today, at least by, you know, civilians on the street. So can you give us some, who is Brooks Atkinson? Or do you want me to tell the people who Brooks Atkinson is?
I would love to hear you tell people who Brooks Atkinson is, and I will be happy to tell people who Brooks Atkinson really is.
Yeah, honestly, I'm a little afraid to do it myself. So why don't you do it, David? Did you ever meet Brooks Atkinson?
No, no. Oh. He died in 1984, so long before, not that long before
I met Hirschfeld,
just a couple of years. Yeah. But he had already been out of New York.
Okay.
No, Atkinson is a really, really important figure, not only in the world of Hirschfeld, but in the American theater. He is probably the single most important critic of the American stage of the 20th century.
Bigger than George Kaufman.
Oh, much bigger than George Kaufman. Kaufman's import comes not from the work he did as a writer for newspapers, but as a playwright and as a director.
True.
Atkinson was the theater critic for the New York Times between 1925 and 1960. And the only time he's not there is 5 years during the war and right after, when he asked the New York Times, he felt that the great drama was not happening on the New York stage during the war. He knew it was happening in Europe and in Japan and in China and Asia. So he asked. He had a very cushy job at that point. Wow. Nobody was asking Brooks Atkinson to go anywhere. He gave up this great perch to go to first China and then Moscow, where he won a Pulitzer Prize in 1947 for his writing from... He wasn't reviewing theater. He was writing sort of foreign cables.
Like a war correspondent?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and right after the war.
I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, there you have it.
So I would have completely... You guys would have never known that information.
But it there he really changed the style of reviewing. He gave us probably some of the most intelligent reviewing of the plays of the period that he was the critic that the theater had had, because he didn't see himself as a critic. He saw himself as a reviewer. He shared a lot of similarities with Hirschfeld in the sense that they had great power. They did not, they didn't use it for anything other than their love of the theater. And so his reviews did not tell you the plot of the shows. Much like a Hirschfeld drawing, might show you a lot of the action in it, but it does not tell you the plot. He addressed the themes, the acting, the music of the shows, the ideas behind it. And he would go to the opening nights. He would race back to the Times office when he finished seeing the show and started writing. He wrote in longhand. He would finish a paragraph, and the copy boy would take the paragraph to set it in type while he wrote the next paragraph. So he did not see the finished review until it was set in newspaper print.
And he kind of wasn't editing himself. Is that what I'm hearing? Like, whatever he thought, he wrote down, and that's what he was going to say.
Right. And so he knew that he understood what the job required. You know, he was a journalist. He was not, I think, much different than someone who was reporting on a fire. Hmm. You know, nobody wants to say, wait, let me think about all the things and track down everything.
Right.
You file some copy, and then you, when you get more information, you write more about it.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing to think about.
Exactly.
This is, yeah.
His reviews would appear in the daily newspaper. And then on Sunday, he had a column in what was first called the drama section and then called Arts and Leisure. Although I think actually he worked primarily in a drama section. Mm-hmm. And he had a Sunday column, front page of the section, mm-hmm. that allowed him to spend more time thinking about the plays.
Interesting.
And his period of reviewing coincides with the rise of a new serious drama in America. I mean, we, of course, think of American theater and American plays as, of course, there were that. But when he started reviewing as early in the 1920s. He was born in 1894, so he was 9 years older than Hirschfeld. He had gone to Harvard. But his interest was, you know, even as a boy, he put out his own newspaper. He loved newspapers.
Wow.
And he started reviewing theater in the Boston area. And then he wanted to come to New York. And so he wrote the New York Times and asked them to be their theater critic.
Mm.
Well, they had a theater critic, but they liked what they saw in him, so they made him the editor of the New York Times Book Review, which just strikes me as wild.
Well, Hirschfeld was the art director at Selznick Pictures when he was 19, right?
Right.
So maybe that's the time to be alive. That's the time to be a teenager looking for a job.
Yes.
1920s in New York, now that I'm saying it out loud, that does kind of make sense.
Remember, there's 14 papers.
Right.
They're morning and afternoon papers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a much different world.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of opportunity, and he wanted to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And so he spent 3 years as the book review editor, and finally there was an opening. Stark Young left the New York Times, and Brooks Atkinson was hired as the theater reviewer.
Wow.
And he started, you know, sort of as like a cub reporter, just getting whatever, you know, theater that they thought he should review. But soon he really became the dean of theater critics, and he really championed playwrights that we now consider as legendary, like Eugene O'Neill, Sean O'Casey, Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, William Saroyan. You know, these were big names to us, but
right.
for him, they were just new playwrights.
Yeah.
And he saw the value in their work, and he championed them, particularly Sean O'Casey and Eugene O'Neill. He was a very big, when other people did not understand the value of O'Neill, he got it.
Mm.
He was also credited with really getting people to appreciate and support Off-Broadway.
Interesting.
In fact, in 1952, he what is generally considered the beginning of the current Off-Broadway, as we know it now, was a production of Summer and Smoke, Tennessee Williams' Summer and Smoke, at Circle in the Square. And Hirschfeld did a drawing of it, which if you, it shows the action on stage, but it, you see the audience, and in the audience is Al and Dolly Hirschfeld, and sitting next to them is Brooks Atkinson. And in fact, in his review, he, or in his Sunday piece, he talks about things that Hirschfeld said about the play. And it's really, it helps to boost the play. Oh, essentially, while Atkinson is given credit for supporting this, it's accompanied by a Hirschfeld drawing. So everybody looked at it. Right. So, and he and Hirschfeld shared that interest in Off-Broadway. I know I've probably said it before on this podcast, but Hirschfeld was a Tony nominator for many years. And
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He was a Tony voter, of course, for many years.
Oh, but he was a nominator. Interesting.
And he did it for many years, but there got to be a point where he thought Off-Broadway should be recognized for, you know, they were producing all these great shows and great theater. And these were men who valued the theater, you know, whether it was happening in, you know, the great stages on Broadway, or whether it was happening in storefronts downtown or in another city.
Yeah. As David Leopold says, great theater doesn't just happen on Broadway.
It's true. It's true. And they understood that. And so things that we take for granted now are thoughts right. about the theater were championed and really introduced by Brooks Atkinson. Mm. And when he was the critic, most people found him to be the go-to critic. Mm-hmm. He could open or he could close a show with a bad review. Yeah. A power that he was uncomfortable with, really tried not to have. You know, he was all about supporting other critics as well. He didn't feel like he was the only voice. But here's what Arthur Miller said when he died.
When who died?
When Brooks Atkinson passed away. There cannot have been another critic as trusted as Brooks Atkinson was by so large a proportion of the theater-going public. He's the only one who can be said to have presided over Broadway. For most people, it was probably less his analytical insights that mattered than his common sense and the air of total candor that his reviews carried with them. He followed no bandwagon, viewed each production pragmatically for what it tried to accomplish rather than what he would have preferred it to attempt, and was not at all afraid to be moved. Above all, he made the reader see what he had seen and thus left some room for dissent. His presence lent the theater a dignity and importance it did not usually merit, but his influence served to raise the sights of everyone it touched.
Mm. Sounds like Hirschfeld, really, too. Yeah,
isn't it remarkable? Yeah. That's what I thought when I read it. Yeah. They were two peas in a pod.
They were doing the same thing by different mediums.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And it was complimentary. Mm-hmm. Hirschfeld wasn't doing drawings for Atkinson's articles on Sunday, but they appeared, right. His column appeared literally right next to Hirschfeld's mm-hmm. drawings. And so Hirschfeld was saying, this is what's opening this week. And Atkinson would be talking about, this is what opened last week. Mm. And so they were really always sort of feeding into each other.
Interesting.
And as I said, Hirschfeld shows up in some of those Sunday columns. After the premiere of William Saroyan's The Beautiful People, Atkinson, in his Sunday column, talks about going to Hirschfeld's studio after the show with Saroyan, Hirschfeld, and Don Freeman, who was also in the show. And I just think, I mean, where would you see something like that? We to get this sort of intimate view of these giants of the theater after a show, which nobody knew how it was going to be received.
Right.
They all had their opinions about it, but they didn't know how the public would receive it. And, you know, Arthur Gelb talked about that, you know, Atkinson, again, like Hirschfeld, never missed an opening night, you know. And unlike Hirschfeld, when Atkinson went to the theater, he stayed in a seat at intermission because he did not want to be influenced by the gossip he might hear at intermission.
Yeah. Hirschfeld got up at intermission.
I'm sure he did.
I'm learning so much this episode. Okay, you don't know for sure if he got it. I mean,
oh, I know
I guess if I have to go to the bathroom, I get up. Otherwise, I stay in my seat.
Hirschfeld was a much more social character.
That's true. Yes.
And I think he was very good at compartmentalizing because when he did, he wasn't as affected by gossip.
Yeah.
Because that didn't change his drawings.
Right. The drawing is
based on what he saw. Not what he heard.
Right.
Not the, he was trying to capture what he saw. So it really wasn't affected by that. And Hirschfeld was also a much more social character. Mm-hmm. Atkinson, many times over the years, talks about how Hirschfeld was the type of person that nobody... they did a book together in 1947 called Broadway Scrapbook,
right,
which was a collection of his reviews, Atkinson's reviews, and Hirschfeld drawings.
Brilliant.
This is what... In Broadway Scrapbook, the only thing that Atkinson wrote for the book was an introduction. And in that introduction, he writes... Friends of Chekhov used to say that they never knew when he did his writing, since he always seemed to have so much time for sociability. That's one of the mysteries of Hirschfeld. I know he does a prodigious amount of work, but he never gives the impression of working. He is never too busy to go to the theater, on short notice too, nor too busy to plunge wholeheartedly into the muddled affairs of his friends, for he has a versatile helping hand for all kinds of people, and he is never too busy to drop everything and plunge into an argument. And that, I think, tells you, Atkinson was a bookish guy. He looked like a university professor. Mm. Hirschfeld looked just like Hirschfeld. Mm. And he did have this ability. Friends came to him, you know, and he did love an argument.
You know,
I was reasoning recently. Pauline Kael, the great New Yorker film critic, comes to New York. She's just starting. And Sidney Lumet, the director Sidney Lumet, invites her for dinner at a dinner that includes Al Hirschfeld. Not surprising, the two men were great friends. Well, over drinks before dinner, Hirschfeld gets into, I wouldn't call it an argument, but it was a heated discussion. Mm-hmm. And about what a critic is for. Mm. And Hirschfeld finally said to her, what is it, why do you write? Mm. And she looked at him and pointed to Sidney Lumet, so I can tell him what to do. And Sidney Lumet wrote about this and said, I then realized I should be very scared of this person. But there was Hirschfeld.
Yeah.
You know, he told me stories of getting into an argument with Gian Milli, the photographer, the Life magazine photographer, over that Hirschfeld's contention was you had with photography, if you were there at the right moment, you could create great art.
Hmm.
You know, whereas drawing, you had to sort of make an effort to do it.
Mm.
And of course, Milli had a different opinion. And as Hirschfeld told me the story
a little bit.
Yes.
I can see where you might get offended by that as a photographer. I understand the point he's making, but maybe don't say that part out loud.
Well, they get into an argument and it's decided they'll go to Milli's studio.
Mm.
And they bring along some of their friends like Boris Aronson and Don Freeman. Mm. I think Michael Kidd was there. You know, it's in the Hirschfeld world, those are the usual suspects. Mm-hmm. And they go there. Milli takes a photograph, and then it's Hirschfeld's turn. He's going to take a portrait of Clifford Odets, who was also there.
He's going to draw a portrait?
No, he's going to take a photograph to show that he can take as good a photo. But before he takes the photograph, he pulls Barnes Aronson aside and says, when I give you the sign, break this plate over the back of his head. Which happens. And of course, it produces a fantastic photo. And I said, well, how did the photos come out? And Hirschfeld sort of, when he told me the story, he smiled. He's like, oh, Gian said the film didn't get developed. You know,
right.
Something was wrong with it. But that was Hirschfeld. And
that's
it was
funny.
He was a great admirer of Milli's work. And I know, I'm pretty confident that Milli would have understood what Hirschfeld was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
They might get into an argument. Right. They might not see eye to eye, but I think it was very hard to stay mad at Al Hirschfeld.
Yeah, it's dull otherwise if you agree on everything. Oh, that's a great... I've never heard that Hirschfeld story before. That's a funny one.
No,
I can totally see it. up to his old tricks.
Well, you know, this this introduction to Broadway scrapbook, Atkinson also continues to tell us things about Hirschfeld that we don't know.
Try me.
So in Broadway scrapbook, Brooks Atkinson tells us a lot about Hirschfeld and really about their relationship. So if you want to get a sense, in it, he writes, "Al is one of the persons I regard as essential to general well-being, for he is a dynamo of goodwill and a constant source of original ideas. During the past decade, his bold and satiric drawings of actors have provided the principal art for the drama page. Although his style is audacious, it was not long after he began that actors were asking for the privilege of being lampooned by him, for they realized that it is an enviable distinction. He has always been admired by other artists who understand the ingenuity of his compositions, the freshness of his ideas, the skill of his line, and his understanding and love of the theater. Some of them began to imitate him about 5 years ago, which is a sign of his national eminence, and now little echoes of Al pop out of odd corners all over the country. Everyone acknowledges that he is the master of the medium." And then later on, what's so interesting, this was published in 1947, and he writes, "At the moment when I'm writing these lines, Al is battering his way around the world with his sketchbooks, and I don't know what figures and drawings from the Sunday Times he will select to go into this book, but when he gets home, he will assemble the material very promptly and arrange all the details skillfully, meanwhile giving the impression that he has nothing much to do except talk, go to the theaters, visit art museums, ferret out bad movies, which he adores ironically, sneakies he calls them, and hang around his favorite Sixth Avenue coffee pot." So, I mean, this is the kind of information we get from a friend who is also a very good observer, who Hirschfeld has been completely at home with, and that he is at home with Hirschfeld. And so we get, I think these are very revealing, intimate looks at Hirschfeld, even if they're fun. Even some of these things are not new to us.
Right.
But you hear it from a friend who's experiencing it in real time, and all of a sudden it's even crazier. He gives us, in fact, in here, how he worked for the Times. He said, "Although his finished drawings look racy and easy, Al is a hard workman. Generally, he receives his assignment on Friday. From that time until the next Wednesday, he does very little but concentrate on the preparation of his drawing. He goes to the play, which may be in Boston, Philadelphia, or Pittsburgh at the moment. He sketches scenes and makes notes of actors during the performance and probably backstage as well. Back again at his studio, he has a versatile barber's chair to use at his drawing board. He starts working up a composition in the shape and according to the relative dimensions that have been agreed upon. After two or three sketches, he sees in his mind what he is going to do and then proceeds to do it carefully. About noon on Wednesday, Al bobs cheerfully into the office with the finished drawing, which is about as big as he is. Everyone stops what he is doing to enjoy it, for Al's drawings always introduce some merriment into our department."
Aww.
You know, in the Great Gray Lady, as it was known, you know, here comes Hirschfeld, who's doing something that everybody can enjoy. You know, as I was going through the archive for material for this episode, I found these letters from the publisher of the New York Times right around this period, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger. And it was these letters were from the late 50s and early 60s, where he talks about, boy, you know, my eyesight is, I got new glasses and now I can really find the Ninas. Or he even wrote to Hirschfeld one time about, your drawing had a 3 next to it, but I found 4 Ninas in it.
He's just like everybody else.
Yeah, it turns out they're all Hirschfeld fans and Nina counters. So these two men were very close. And there's a drawing that Hirschfeld did at this time of the two of them, artist and critic, escaping the theater.
Yeah.
That shows the two of them running out as the actors are taking a curtain call. That is not...
They've got work to do.
Yeah, exactly. It is not disrespect.
No.
When I go to the theater and people are taking curtain calls and the audience is leaving, that to me is really rude. But when you're a theater critic who's got to make a deadline, there's a good reason to do that.
Yeah.
needing to get home to your babysitter, it can wait another 5 minutes. You know, you can, you'll be able to do it. Please stay seated during the curtain calls. And now I will get off my soapbox.
Atkinson also did the introduction to the first American theater book. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
So he's actually done quite a bit of writing for Herschel.
Oh, yeah. No, he wrote a funny review of Show Business is No Business.
Oh, really?
In his Sunday column when it came out. After he retires from being a critic in 1960, he has a regular feature in the Times called Critic at Large. And in 1963, he visits Hirschfeld in his studio and writes about it. Hirschfeld's working on a new CBS series. You know, series of drawings of the new season.
For the CBS.
And I quote part of that. I took an excerpt of that for the new American theater book because it just captured what Brooks Atkinson not only thought about Hirschfeld, but how the theater thought of Hirschfeld. And then when he gets back into printmaking in Rhythm, it's Atkinson who writes the foreword to the portfolio, the Rhythm portfolio. And I found letters that Hirschfeld had saved from Brooks Atkinson saying, you know, thank you for asking me to write this piece. Now, of course, this is 1970 at this point. And, you know, thank you for writing, you know, for asking me to write this piece. I always enjoy writing about you. But if there's something that I said that shouldn't be there or something more, let me know. You know, he's
edited as you see fit.
Right. And he's willing to write more or less you know, he wants to please his friend.
Yeah.
Because he has a great deal of respect.
Yeah.
The letters that I looked at between the two of them, after Brooks retired, he eventually moves up to a sort of country place in Durham, New York. And he and Al, write letters to each other. And one of them, Brooks Atkinson says, I know I could give you a call, but I prefer writing.
Aww,
and so, and Hirschfeld, I wish we had Hirschfeld's end of the correspondence because a lot of times Brooks starts off the letters, well, that last letter was so made, you know, was so fun or, you know, really loved it or we had a great time with it. Or, and I know the way that Hirschfeld wrote letters and he was a funny guy. By not being, it wasn't jokes.
Trying to be funny, yeah.
Like Perlman, it was his descriptions of things that make you understand the humor, the irony, the sort of futileness of doing anything. Yeah. And so they had a really good relationship. This was a really warm relationship. And even in the years that I knew Hirschfeld, when Brooks' name would come up, I could tell he had a very, very high opinion of this person and really regarded him as a huge figure in the world of the American theater. So it's not surprising to me that being given an opportunity to do a book, you know, Hirschfeld's Broadway, who would Hirschfeld think about writing something for? It was Atkinson.
Right, of course.
And once Atkinson comes up with this idea of the Lively Years, I'm sure Hirschfeld was totally on board. Yeah. Because he's working with somebody he respects and admires. And it means he's going to get to do a lot of new drawings, which for Hirschfeld, that's the nicest compliment you can give him is a drawing for him to do.
Well, yeah, so let's dig into the Lively Years.
Sure.
The book. The drawings in this by Hirschfeld are, there's a few different kinds of drawings. Mm-hmm. Some drawings are from the time of when the play premiered on Broadway. Yes. So these were drawings that originally ran in the New York Times or the Herald Tribune when the plays were being performed, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then the cool thing about this book, you know, from 1973, sometimes Hirschfeld didn't draw the original production for a variety of reasons, one of which, you know, he was away for what, 7 months?
Nine months in 1947.
When he was traveling the world with Perlman, that's the longest time he was away from Broadway. And maybe he just wasn't assigned a play that week and he didn't draw it or he didn't like that original drawing. So he did new drawings of these older plays.
Correct.
Like a, I guess we would call them a retrospective drawing.
Yes.
Right? That's what we call them.
Exactly.
So there are some new drawings that are done specifically for this book. They weren't drawn for the newspaper. They were drawn for the Lively Years because for whatever reason, there wasn't a drawing of the play.
Exactly. There are about 85 drawings in the book. And out of that, I would say close to 60 are new drawings.
Wow, and 60 new drawings.
I mean, it's
that's, and we, I think we maybe already said that. It's a record, right?
It's a record, yeah, by far. There's no other book that he illustrates, even all Perlman, the Perlman book, yeah, books.
Even Perlman books, which have a lot of drawings in them.
Which have a lot of drawings. Yeah. It turns out there's not as many as that.
It's a lot.
And this is really, the book is dedicated to the Performing Arts Library, the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, and to the library at the Players Club, because that's where Hirschfeld went to look at photos and get examples of the work, to see what it was, because he didn't want to trust his memory. He'd like to get the facts right.
Interesting.
And he looked at the drawings he had done or productions that were going to be written about. And some he decides to do new drawings. And others, like Guys and Dolls, The Iceman Cometh.
Mm. He's like, no, these are pretty good.
Yeah, right.
He's like, no, I really got this one.
Yeah.
We'll run this one.
A drawing of Cradle Will Rock.
Right.
He uses his 1938 drawing.
But he adds a Nina.
Yeah.
I remember that was early in my tenure. And I saw that and I was like, what the?
Yeah.
Like, this date is wrong. Because what's the year on that? 38?
1938.
38. And of course, Nina's born in 45. So it's like, what gives here?
There's another one of Born Yesterday,
which
was part of a triptych.
Yep.
And when it ran originally, there were no Ninas in it. But now Judy Holliday's hair had seven of them. He did that for this book.
For the book.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he drew it right on the original drawing and then just photographed that. So
that's really going to mess historians up, Hirschfeld. It's really going to mess people up if you do it right on the original drawing. I'm not even going to get into the fact that he puts glue on the original drawings. We'll cut out parts of the original drawings. We'll tape over and paste something new on the original drawings.
We look at them as art objects, and Hirschfeld did to a great extent. But for many years, nobody, I think including the artist, understood that there was secondary value to
these. Was value as artwork.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Hirschfeld understood that, but he didn't know if anybody else did.
Right, right.
And so when he was working on it, you know, either he was going to have to pay to get a stat made, or he can just do it on the original drawing, because nobody cared about the original drawing.
Yeah.
And so we have some drawings that have been, the biggest problem with them is that Al Hirschfeld got at them.
You can't trust them. You got to really, really inspect them.
Well, I think we talked about this in the episode we did on the American theater books, but... sometimes I'd be in the studio and I would find a drawing that he had really done a number on. You know, he had whited out a chunk of the drawing just to focus on a particular figure that he put into his American theater book. And I would see these, and if he wasn't working on something, there were stray days that he didn't have an assignment right away. And I would bring the drawing over to him and I'd say, well, it would be such a shame. You know, it's such a shame that this has been... looks like this. Do you think you want to fix it at all? And if he didn't have anything going on, he would say, sure.
That's funny.
I remember the one for Louisiana Purchase, which had these dresses made of doilies. And I said, oh, it's too bad you don't have that. He's like, oh, sure I do. And goes into a drawer and pulls out these doilies from, I don't know, 50 years ago.
When's the drawing from? 40?
Yeah, in the 40s. And this is the 90s. And he just pulls out this thing, cuts it out. And you want to talk about what historians are going to know. They'll probably look at the clipping and say, it's slightly different.
Right. Why is the doily in a different... Yeah. The pattern is different. I mean, the pattern's the same, but it's cut in a different
part. You know, it's like the mysterious Ninas that appeared.
Yep, exactly,
you know?
Like it.
I think we should tell people that if you leave your Hirschfeld drawing alone enough, that it might sprout extra Ninas.
Oh, that's a good idea. We can do something
sort
with
of
that.
Nina Chia Pet.
There's a million-dollar idea there in there somewhere.
Copyright David Leopold.
Yeah, there's something to that. We're going to have to... I'm writing that down. We're going to have to expand on that later.
We are not going to do that.
Yes, we are.
Well, let's talk about some of the... So the book is broken down into chapters that are by decade. And for the first one, from 1920 to 1930... A number of the plays, almost all the plays, are not ones that Hirschfeld drew originally.
Hirschfeld didn't start drawing theater till December 1926. So really, you only have 3 years.
Right.
Yeah.
And he, it's, they're great drawings. Mm. I mean, this is a great period for Hirschfeld. He's doing some really incredible work. He's really simplified his work. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that these were retrospective drawings. Mm-hmm. This is really the first time he does retrospective work.
Interesting.
He's 70 years old. Wow. And he's only been drawing what's opening next week.
Right.
What's opening later this year, you know, whether it be a film, TV, or the TV show that's going to be coming on this week.
Right. That's true.
And all of a sudden, with this book, he looks back. Mm. And it's a funny time because that's exactly what Broadway was doing at that time.
True.
You start having the first real revivals of sort of the classic plays, musicals. Mm-hmm. You know, the big hit around this time on Broadway, when this book is, they're working on this book and it comes out, is No, No, Nanette, you know, which had debuted on Broadway 50 years earlier.
Wow.
And it's not covered in this book because it's not a play of social significance, I suppose, or a musical of social significance.
Yeah, earlier I was going to say this is kind of like a compilation of all the best plays from 1920 to 1970, like the best play books, I'm saying. But it's not really. It's deeper than that.
It is deeper than that.
It's not about the what they grossed, you know, at the box office.
Right.
That's not as important.
Well, it's interesting. Atkinson starts this project by going to the best plays and looking at the 10 best plays each year and making his list from that.
Interesting.
And I think that is what leads him to this idea of really only focusing on the plays that comment on current times, you know, current events.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because, of course, the best plays, everyone in the theater, you know, who worked in the theater would have copies of that. And starting in 1952, you have also a compendium of Hirschfeld drawings because they all have these graphic glance by Hirschfeld in there. And he would do that for 50 years. So, you know, looking at their correspondence, we see this project evolve, you know. And Atkinson is writing, I mean, before this, he wrote a book, I think, on bird watching. You know, he
that sounds like a Perlman book, to be honest.
He was a very serious bird watcher. He was also an expert in ocean tides.
What?
Yeah, he liked to go to Atlantic City and spend a month there and essentially watch the water come in and out.
What? Wild.
He was an interesting person who, even in his retirement, was engaged in life. I mean, it's funny to read his letters to Hirschfeld because Hirschfeld is essentially still leading the life that Brooks Atkinson had led in New York. Mm. And even when Atkinson comes into New York for theater events, he often stays at Hirschfeld's.
Of course.
But they're going to go to an event and Atkinson says, "Oh, Al, you'll have to give me a key because I don't think I'm going to stay for the dinner, but I know that you and Dolly will." So, I mean, That
sounds like me and you.
I've never given you a key to my house.
No, we have to go to New York, but we have to drive separately because I'm not going to want to stay at the dinner after.
It's true. well, so starting really in the chapter on the 1930 to 1940, we start seeing more, you know, these are plays that Hirschfeld did draw.
Right,
and in fact,
originally,
we start seeing the first time he uses older drawings.
Mm.
The 20s chapter is all new.
Right, of course.
And in the 30s, the first drawing that is in there that he had used from a, you know, that had appeared originally was his drawing of Henry Hull in Tobacco Road.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice one.
It is a nice one.
Yeah.
And in this context, it looks very contemporary.
Mm.
You know, he found a drawing that he had done 30 years earlier, and it looked like it had just been drawn.
Mm.
And that's a testament to his to his draftsmanship.
Yeah.
And then the 1930s has the most redrawings.
Interesting, really?
Yeah. So the first one I saw in there was Winterset, a Maxwell Anderson play. And he does a new clean drawing of the three leads, Richard Bennett, I forget who the other couple is. And it's very similar to the drawing he did in 1935, except in 1935, there was a view of the city in the background and a bridge, and he's simplifying these.
Yeah.
He concentrates on the performers.
Yeah, all of these new, at least the ones I can think of, all of the new drawings are much more mature style, much more simplified. Yeah, I think you were touching on that earlier, just the time period. He's really grown into this, you know, he's just cutting out all the extra stuff.
Right. Purging the pictures of unnecessary pictorial details.
Absolutely.
And he's focusing on the characters. You know, the set doesn't mean so much, but the characters of the shows, even though he's doing specific actors, he's really drawing the characters of these shows. And Atkinson writes that this is not a book of memories. Mm. He has reread all the plays, you know, and in fact, some of his feelings about the plays are sharply different than what he wrote when they first appeared.
Interesting.
Because, for instance, Winterset is a play by Maxwell Anderson, written in rhyming couplets. Mm. It's sort of loosely based on the Sacco Vanzetti case. And when Atkinson saw it in 1935, he was very moved by it. It was a very important thing that had gone on. It was a big cause célèbre, the Sacco and Vanzetti trial and their eventual execution. But he's reading it in 1970, 71 is when he starts reading these things again. And now he realizes, yeah, the poetry's not that great. And it's kind of flabby. And
so why did he include it in the book?
Because the idea of the show. He could complain about the technique, but it was the ideas that were the most important.
Still see it for what it is at its essence. And
It was still great theater. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't as great as he thought it was.
He remembered. Yeah. Well, it never is.
Well, or sometimes, you know, we have rosy memories where we don't remember all the bad things.
Right.
But we know, he knew that he had his sort of first thought about it because he could read his reviews. He reread the plays before he reread his reviews.
Smart.
And I think he might have written about them before he reread his reviews. And it was only when he reread his reviews that he realized he had come to some different conclusions.
Mm. That's interesting.
And so I think, again, Atkinson and Hirschfeld are very similar in this. They're looking, I'm sure Hirschfeld read many of the plays again, certainly the ones that they were going to be included in the book. And he went to look at his drawings and thought, did this capture it? And, you know, most of the time he says, I can do better. I mean, in the 1930s, he redraws Winterset, Idiot's Delight, which becomes this very classic London Fontaine drawing. There's Golden Boy, which he redraws. That drawing originally was just three portraits of performers. It's in the Hirschfeld Century. But here he gives us more of a character drawing with the lead with his violin and his father and his girlfriend, who's Stella Adler. It's a wonderful drawing in Lively Years. It's much better than what he did in the 1930s. I understand why he did it. Idiot's Delight, I think he probably just thought, oh gosh, I can do better. You know, because they're very similar. The one that he redraws in this chapter that I think is interesting is Abe Lincoln in Illinois. Mm-hmm. That is one of the plays that are also in Broadway Scrapbook.
Right.
And there he used a drawing that he had done, which is a very good drawing, just an individual drawing of Raymond Massey as Abraham Lincoln. But he doesn't use that. But he had just redrawn Abe Lincoln in Illinois for a private commission. This guy's name was Saul Steinberg, not the artist, a finance person, who had wanted Hirschfeld to draw all the Pulitzer Prize winner plays.
Oh, yeah.
And his idea was he wanted a drawing of the play and a drawing of the playwrights.
Right.
And the playwrights were always with the title page from the program.
Right.
And so he draws Abe Lincoln in Illinois. So it's right around the time when this project's starting. Mm. He does, you know, it's a great, wonderful, simple, direct drawing that he does for that Pulitzer Prize series. But he does a new drawing. He does another new drawing that simplifies it even more for Lively Years. So for him, it's just always sort of paring away to get it down to the essentials. And then the same thing in the 40s and the 50s. One of the drawings, again, I use in the Hirschfeld Century is Watch on the Rhine. When it originally appeared in the paper.
So busy.
Yeah.
I mean, a beautiful drawing.
Although at first glance, you may not think of it as a Hirschfeld.
Yeah, it's very detailed.
detailed, and it's a wash drawing. It's got, you know, it doesn't read like the simple line Hirschfeld drawing. And what he does for the book is he takes figures from that drawing and recreates them and simplifies them for this book. It's to see it is really kind of incredible. You know, he just gets it. He just does it better. He keeps doing it better. Same with Skin of Our Teeth. Another busy drawing when it originally appeared in a sort of L-shaped format at the top of the page. And when he draws it for this book, it's just Frederick March and Tallulah Bankhead. Mm. It's so simple and clean. It's a joy to behold, as it were. Well, we shouldn't go I could go through every page of this book, and you know, but we're not going to do a six-part episode on The Lively Years. I don't want the episode to be as long as the 50 years it's been since the book. So I love to hear your favorite drawings in a book.
Oh, you want to pick my favorites?
Yeah.
I go first?
Yeah.
Well, the one I really like the most is There Shall Be No Night.
Wild.
I think it's so nice. It's just a nice drawing. I like the expression Montgomery Clift has on his face.
Mm.
I've always liked that one. And I can remember there was a drawing from is this a 30s play?
40s.
There is an old drawing of it, correct? And this was redrawn for The Lively Years.
Yes.
It actually looks quite similar. It's kind of like they're in the same poses. But now it's, again, like I said before, it's this much more mature Hirschfeld style.
He streamlines it.
Yes, streamlined. Streamlined. That should be a book we do on Hirschfeld. Copyright, Catherine Eastman. Streamlined.
How Hirschfeld took his drawings and streamlined them.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I like that idea. I'm going to come back to that. But that's the one I like. Now, I did pick out two others. As you know, I love to knit.
Yes.
Not a crocheter. Knitting is more complicated, so just get that straight.
For those of you listening at home.
This book has two knitting images. Which I think might be a record.
Watch on the Rhine is one of them.
Watch on the Rhine is one of them. Correct. And this was, of course, we talked about it was redrawn for this book.
Mm-hmm.
There is another drawing in this book that features knitting. Now, I can only think of one other drawing, which is that Russian bear drawing where the, you know, what was that done for?
We don't know. We think it was done for Eastward Ha, but we're not sure.
Yeah, there's a bear that's knitting. But there is another knitting image. I'm trying not to show David the book.
I don't know what it is.
You don't know what it is?
I do not have the works categorized. A man knitting?
Yeah, it's a man knitting.
Even less do I know.
Yeah. Will Gear in Bury the Dead.
Oh, gosh.
He's also knitting.
Well, so that play dealt with the horrors of war in 1937.
Mm.
Will Gear is a amputee in that show.
Yes.
I mean, something that I don't think we think of from this period.
Mm.
It was very much in your face. Irwin Shaw, I think, wrote that. And that play was really blew people's minds.
Mm.
Will Gear, of course, would go on. If people know him at all today, it's because he was Grandpa on The Waltons.
Oh, never watched it.
No, before your time.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah.
That's The Waltons. Yeah.
Good night, John Boy.
Yeah,
good night.
Yeah. No, I never saw that. I will point out he has done a much better job at knitting than Ida Heinemann, maybe who this is, knitting in Watch on the Rhine, because it looks like hers is all unraveled.
Oh, there you go.
But Will Gear actually has a nice little sampler he's doing there.
We're so glad to have the knitting info.
If you want, I will deconstruct all the knitting. I think we just did all three of them. All three of the knitting drawings that Hirschfeld did.
I will argue that there are more knitting.
I think there are a few more. But as I was looking, you told me to pick out my favorites. And as I was looking through the book, I was like, oh my gosh, there are two knitting images. I just thought that was interesting. When else are we not doing a knitting episode, unfortunately.
We promise we're not doing a knitting episode.
I just thought I would point those two out.
Excellent.
What are your favorites, David?
My favorites, I like the front page. Osgood Perkins in the front page. Hirschfeld did not draw this show in 1928. He may have been because he was in Russia.
Mm.
I don't know when it opened. But he didn't draw it in 1928. But when he draws it for the Lively Years, it's just Osgood Perkins on a candlestick phone, and it's a simple, wonderful, you know, the play is about, you know, this newspaper, it's scenes inside a newspaper office, and Osgood Perkins is this hard talking newspaper editor. And what I find so interesting is that when Lincoln Center Theater did a revival of the front page in the 1980s, James McMullen, Jim McMullen, who is famous, justifiably so, for his posters for Lincoln Center Theater, did a great poster for front page, which showed essentially, if not the Osgood Perkins character, a reporter on a candlestick phone. and I don't think he got it from Hirschfeld.
Right.
But I'm not surprised that both artists trying to get to the heart of the play would go to that.
Pick that image, that, interesting.
I also love in the 1930s chapter, there's a drawing of One Third of a Nation, which is a very detailed drawing. It's a different type of drawing. And it's interesting that he would do this for this book. It shows this fire that has happened and all the sort of, you know, firefighters and people. And it's a very complicated drawing, but it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't use much shading in it. Mm-hmm. It's really...
For a drawing about smoke, about fire. Yeah, you would think.
He gets it all in line, and I just think it's brilliant. And then the one that I really love and that I think, again, is a very contemporary piece is Nathan George in No Place to Be Somebody.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic.
If you know our online exhibition, Lost in the Stars, Black Theater Makers, drawn by Hirschfeld, this is the signature image.
Yeah, that Nathan George image, though, is very powerful.
Strong. It's a Black Power, really, drawing. Mm-hmm. And a very important play. We won't go into it here, but go to that exhibition and read about it, because you can even see a clip. There's a film scene from that play.
Wow.
So those are my three favorites, but there are so many great ones.
It really does cover a lot. I mean, Hair is in this.
Right. Right.
Guys and Dolls. Is West Side Story. I think West Side Story.
West Side Story, of course, is in it.
Yeah, there really is a lot.
And then he gets to draw things like Raisin in the Sun, mm-hmm. which he did not get to draw originally. Mm. Why? Who knows? I think obviously a play with a Black cast written by a Black woman probably didn't make the time say this is what we should cover or this is what we should have Hirschfeld cover. But he does a wonderfully sensitive drawing of the mother and the son, played by Sidney Poitier, in an embrace in this. It's
a really nice, beautiful drawing. Also a nice drawing.
Yeah. So The Lively Years was published in 1973 by Association Press. If you can find copies of that, which are available online. In 1986, DeCapo Press republished the book, and the original book had Saroyan's The Time of Your Life on the cover, and the reprint has Cradle Will Rock on the cover, and it's only a soft cover.
I thought there was. I was saying the other day we were looking for a copy of the book, and I said, I'm pretty sure there's a hardcover and a paperback version of this book, which is just different.
Yeah, published 13 years apart.
Yeah.
Now, the book got great reviews. People loved it. Of course, they all saw it as an Atkinson book, which is funny.
That's funny.
Because it was really a Hirschfeld book that he brought Atkinson into. But that didn't bother Hirschfeld. Although Atkinson himself, in his later years, in letters to Hirschfeld, would comment. It's funny. He first, in some of the letters, says, oh, yeah, that book we did together, you know, that started off as your book. But by 1982, he's writing to Hirschfeld and saying, I looked at this book again. Your drawings are the best part of it.
Aww.
And I still feel bad I took this book away from you and made it into something different. You know, and of course, I'm sure Hirschfeld never felt that.
No. Right.
Was delighted to be working with Brooks. Delighted to that he was, that, you know, Brooks Atkinson was writing.
Right.
You know, and that he was writing about the theater. Because if you love the theater, you wanted Brooks Atkinson to be writing about the theater. And by 1973, he hadn't written about the theater for 10 years.
Wow.
And this would be his last substantial book, his last book. His really last word on the theater. He doesn't really write about the theater after this.
Wow.
But this is really a review of not only all the theater that he saw, but the last chapter, you know, from 1960 to 1973, are mostly shows that he did not review when they originally came out.
Right.
And so it's fascinating to see him sort of approach these. Mm. When Hair premiered on Broadway, he was up in Durham, New York. Mm. Did he see it? I'm sure he saw it.
Right.
He didn't write about it. Mm. And so the only writing that we have by Brooks Atkinson of this really historic production is in the lively years.
Interesting.
So Brooks Atkinson died in January 1984. 11 years after this book came out. It was a big blow to the world of the theater. The Tonys decide to come up with an award called the Brooks Atkinson Award. And they describe it as, the Brooks Atkinson Award has been established to, quote, celebrate individuals who have contributed a lifetime of outstanding creative theater achievement. And although Hirschfeld had received a Lifetime Achievement Award in 1974, they were giving him another one. And in fact, he is literally the only recipient of the Brooks Atkinson Award.
I like it that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very appropriate.
Yeah, it makes sense. I wouldn't want it any other way.
And
I don't think Brooks or Hirschfeld would have wanted
right.
it any
other
way.
Well, I think they would have been the first to say all the other people have substantial lifetime achievement.
I'm sure if they were able to, though, they'd share a smile that Hirschfeld's the only recipient of the Brooks Atkinson Award.
He and I never discussed it, but mm-hmm. I'm sure he would have labeled it insane.
Yeah. it's sweet.
What is interesting, reading Brooks Atkinson writing about Hirschfeld, he actually says that at one point.
Mm.
He says, when Al Hirschfeld says something is insane, it's almost as if it's a seal of
That's
approval.
That's where you get it.
Yeah.
It's a Brooks Atkinson quote.
Really just kind of incredible. And in 1984, Hirschfeld was, I don't know what they thought, they thought something was wrong with Hirschfeld, but the Drama League honored him with a Lifetime Achievement Award as well. So, I mean...
That's funny.
And they're telling him, and certainly at that point, he had been working in the theater for close to 60 years. The fact is, he had almost another 20 years left.
It's not even close to being done.
And as you know, in 1993, they want to give him another Lifetime Achievement Award. And I remind the American Theater Wing that they've already given him two. And so Liza Minnelli, who was hosting that year, just announces from the stage that it's Hirschfeld's birthday soon. He's going to be 93. And they give him a standing ovation. They ask him first to stand up, and they give him a standing ovation. And he looks, he's touched that people want to do it. But also, I can see in his eyes, like, when do I get to sit down? It is, I think, interesting that they both end up with theater's name for them.
That is interesting.
The theater is named for him in 1964.
Mm.
Actually, one of the first productions is Josephine Baker, which Hirschfeld does a drawing for.
Oh, interesting.
When she brought her show.
That 1964 drawing.
Yeah.
I thought that was just made for a print.
No. That was that appeared in the paper a couple days before.
I'm learning so much today.
Yeah.
I'm learning so much. I mean, when would I have... Why would I know that?
Right. It's I just look at these things because I've been looking at them a long time.
Yeah.
When it was announced that the Brooks Atkinson was going to be renamed the Lena Horne, I mean, no one can argue with an honor given to Lena Horne, an extraordinary performer and a very important figure outside of the world of performance and music and acting, civil rights. She was incredibly important and a significant figure. It's just unfortunate that Brooks Atkinson now loses that on Broadway, because probably a lot of people on Broadway today have no idea who Brooks
Atkinson
is.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody. A lot of people, unfortunately, don't know who Hirschfeld is anymore.
Well,
they know them from the theater.
If you're listening to this podcast, you know who Al Hirschfeld is.
That's why I said a lot of people. But yeah, it's a shame we can't build new Broadway theaters. I mean, I guess you could. Minkoff's relatively new.
Oh, sure.
But it's hard. Construction's hard in New York. And so it's much easier to rename and rather than build a new one,
The new theaters today are sold, a lot of them are the United Airlines Theater.
Right, Coca-Cola.
That's unfortunately where we're at. Well, before the theater was called the Brooks Atkinson Theater, it was called the Mansfield. And it was for a very important actor from the turn of the century, Richard Mansfield.
Mm.
But you know, time marches on and we forget those people. Martin Beck built a theater, put his name on it, and he lost that too. Yep. You know, so that's show business, I suppose.
I guess so.
One would hope that at least he had a good run. He had about 60 years. I hope the Hirschfeld has at least 60 years, yeah, if not more.
Yeah.
Because his career on Broadway is even longer than Brooks Atkinson, which was already pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So that is, we could go on about Brooks Atkinson and Al Hirschfeld all day. They have told me we cannot do that.
We have to
Our
stop
producer, Doug Coons, he just looks at me sometimes and shakes his head. And I know I've gone on too long when that happens. So listen, if you enjoy this episode, will you please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you listen to this on? It really helps people to find the podcast, and it really does a lot for our very fragile egos.
Mm-hmm. And if you know someone whose favorite book is The Lively Years, send them this podcast episode.
Yes.
So they can listen to it.
And if you've never seen The Lively Years, I strongly encourage you to go out.
I did. I looked on Amazon. You can get it. It's like $6.
Wow.
Because I don't have a copy of The Lively Years. I have a copy of most Hirschfeld books. I do not have a copy of The Lively Years. It's $6. I mean, they're all used, of course.
But that's
pretty cheap.
There's a version that is published without Hirschfeld's drawings.
Ooh. No, it has this original cover. I saw the hardback, the hardcover.
That's the one you want.
With the drawing on the front. So yeah, just be careful. Watch out for that. But it is cheap and available to purchase. Oh. So you can get them. It's not like, I want you to get the original Manhattan Oasis.
Okay, yes.
That's $800. $800
later.
That. Right. Or get the original Harlem book. No. So you can get The Lively Years, and I encourage you to do so because it is fun to look at.
And I think you'll be surprised. Mm-hmm. Order a copy and just pick it up. I mean, Atkinson's text on any particular play is not very long. It's about a page or so.
But there's a lot in here.
No, there's a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a Hirschfeld fan and you don't have this book, you are missing
a lot.
85 drawings of some of the greatest theater that happened in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And that alone should make you say, I
got to get it. Yeah, we don't make any money off these purchases of The Lively Years. But yeah, pick it up.
If you'd like to donate to the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, you can go to our website and do that, alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
We have a Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Al Hirschfeld Foundation, or Al Hirschfeld, and a YouTube, Al Hirschfeld Foundation YouTube channel, where we have all kinds of amazing videos we're making, so check those out.
There is a great video of Catherine telling you all about the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
Gosh. Yes, that's
And
me.
If you go to our YouTube page, whether you want to hear it or not, it's going to start. She is going to be talking at you faster than you can think.
Yep.
And if you have questions, comments, corrections, advice on how to deal with Catherine, please write info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
And if you would like David to talk less in the podcast and hear me talk more in the podcast, you can also write info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
Nobody writes in that letter.
Every single person I see.
It is true. Most people, when I meet them and they realize that we do the podcast,
they say, you're so mean to Catherine.
No, they always tell me their favorite part of the podcast is Catherine. I don't know what that's supposed to make me feel like, but I'll tell you, it's my favorite part too.
Oh, thank you, David. It's my favorite part too.
Yeah, we know that.
All right, let's wrap it up here.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening this far.
We will speak to you when we do.
Bye.